Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My name is Molly McLaughlin, and I own a company that optimizes sleep through technology, accountability, and behavioral change. Each week, I'll be interviewing world-class experts ranging from doctors, innovators, and thought leaders to give actionable tips and strategies that you can implement to become a more skillful sleeper. Let's jump into your dose of practical sleep training. Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My guest today is Nick Coetzee, and he is the founder of Mycondria. It's a red light therapy company, and this actual episode is part of a series of podcasts that I'd actually recorded last year and bring them out of the archives and delivering it to you now. I really hope that you enjoy this podcast where we go pretty deep on the science so far to date of red light therapy. I'm sure many of you may have heard of it, but getting a real connection or building that bridge and connection as to why this could be a strategy for improving your sleep and your health results. But a little bit more about Nick. He studied and received his bachelor's in sports science and his bachelor's and honors in biokinetics and is the founder of Mycondria. He is someone that you should definitely follow on social media, giving out lots of different information, clearly very passionate on this topic of how your light environment can affect your health. Certainly, we speak a lot on this podcast about circadian rhythm optimization, and Nick has really made that part of his life's work is to really help not only others understand that, but also live that himself and kind of that bi-directional relationship of teaching that and making sure that his life is aligned with that as well. So I think you're going to really enjoy and hear his passion on this podcast. And of course, if you do have any sort of questions around some of the information that we got into, don't hesitate to head on over to sleepasaskill.com. You can see the show notes for this podcast. You can also see it on whatever platform you're listening to. And check out Nick's information. Follow him, like I said, on different social media platforms. Lots of information there. And then if you do go to sleepisaskill.com, we do have that little bot system in the right-hand corner that any, you know, questions that you have in real time, don't hesitate to ask, and we'll make sure we get those addressed, whether from Nick or for any questions that you're dealing with in the area of optimizing your sleep. Without further ado, let's jump into the podcast. All right, you all, I'm so excited to announce our new sponsor, Soul CBD. When I was at my lowest point dealing with my insomnia, CBD was one of the key compounds that I leaned into to combat my crippling anxiety, calm my nervous system, and support my journey to entrain my circadian rhythm. But of all the brands out there, where can you go that you can have a strong trust in their quality? Well, Soul CBD is completely THC-free, organically farmed, gluten-free, and third-party tested for toxins. And bonus, the company is created by a brother and sister duo who have both made wellness their mission in life. And I'm good friends with Angie Lee, their co-founder. So I've seen her commitment to health and sleep behind the scenes, and she really walks her talk. Now, one of the things that is great about Soul is that they aim to help create rituals around your CBD use, and sleep and rituals are best friends. For instance, I love that Soul CBD supports a nighttime bath routine with their CBD bath bombs, which help to combat stress, soothe aching muscles with a mix of CBD essential oils and dead sea salts. Another ritual that we aim to cultivate in the realm of sleep optimization is circadian rhythm intermittent fasting, which is really all about eating your meals between sunrise and sunset. And Soul CBD has very popular gummies that can serve as a nighttime dessert or treat to look forward to without caving to ice cream. Nice alternative. My go-tos personally are their oils, capsules, topicals, and even CBD bath bombs. It's helpful for anyone who struggles with anxiety, pain, or sleep. Now, particularly when I'm traveling, I like to lean into as many things as possible to help with inflammation, and CBD does just that. Now, here's a really cool part cart, you get 15% off automatically and free shipping when you go to mysoul.com/sleep is a skill. I'm going to say that again. You get 15% off automatically. All you have to do is go to this link, which will be in the show notes, mysoulcbd.com/sleep is a skill. All right, let's get on to the show. And welcome to the Sleep is a Skill podcast. Nick, I am so grateful that you're able to take the time on, you know, another side of the planet to actually have this conversation today. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Molly. I'm really excited to talk to you guys. And talking about sleep and light is absolutely up my alley. So really excited to talk to your audience about some of that content today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, already in our kind of preamble before we started recording, it already became very abundantly clear that we've got some synergy and similar stories around sleep and light. So I think it can make a lot of sense to begin at the beginning and to hear a bit of your story of how you got to this place, how you've become kind of a thought leader in this area around light, sleep, health, and how you've transformed your own life in it as it relates to those things.
Yeah. So I originally studied a BSc in sports science, and then I did a postgraduate in biokinetics. And I started studying in 2013. I never used to be healthy at all. I, you know, just ate whatever I wanted, got away with most things, was able to kind of skim through high school. And then when I got to university, I got this, you know, slap of reality, realizing, you know, I needed to up my performance. And I basically, within my first semester of studying, I didn't quite, you know, make it. I failed two of my subjects, actually. And, you know, a lot of my friends and family, my loved ones had these like really high expectations. They thought I was going to do really well. And that I quickly realized that turned into me letting a lot of people down. So in 2013, I started looking into the whole field of biohacking. And this was, you know, just to like level up my performance, make sure I could show up as my best self for both, you know, myself and for those who loved and cared for me. And I quickly realized there were so many things outside of just diet and exercise that we were not looking at. You know, diet and exercise, most of us were looking at it and probably getting it about 80% right. But then when I started looking at all these different fields, one thing I'd never paid attention to was sleep. And what I very quickly realized is when it comes to sleep, you know, the most important factor, we've got all these different factors that basically can optimize our sleep pattern, or let's say your circadian rhythm. And of all of these factors, the most important one was light. And I was shocked when I started doing the research and seeing all these different, you know, areas of health that no one was really looking at. I realized how far gone we are from nature. I mean, when we talk about food, you know, a lot of people approach it in a, you know, they use like a paleo approach. What did our ancestors eat? When we start looking at our light environment and we start comparing that to what we evolved to live under and the type of light we would have been exposed to if we were outside in nature, and we compare that to what's inside, we see that there is, you know, this huge kind of disconnect between us and nature. And, you know, of all the different fields, when I was, you know, looking at biohacking, I was optimizing my diet, my exercise, and all these fields, what I very quickly realized was optimizing my light environment is probably the most important thing that I looked at. And after my studies, I started practicing as a biokineticist, which is probably something similar to a physiotherapist overseas. And we were, you know, the standard approach to health is just use exercise as a mode of treatment. And what I was doing with a lot of my clients back then was, you know, optimizing these other little things, you know, getting their light environment right, you know, focusing on all these different things around circadian rhythms. And I found that, you know, there was no area of health that sleep didn't seem to impact. I had, you know, people that were struggling with knee injuries that had been going on for years. And because they started focusing on their light environment and increasing their sleep quality, you know, those kind of niggles would disappear. There was people who had terrible blood glucose levels. They were diabetic. And, you know, they were eating, let's say, like a ketogenic diet. And they were still, you know, not quite optimal. And they found when they start optimizing all these different factors around sleep, we started seeing these great improvements. So that's when I started, you know, I originally actually started with a blue blocker glasses company. And those are the glasses that help to block blue light at night. And those help to, you know, optimize your circadian rhythm in your sleep and try and create more of a natural light environment at night. And then what I realized, you know, at the one end of the spectrum, we're blocking light because we're getting too much of it. But almost, you know, not more important, but just equally as important is, you know, when you look at sunlight versus artificial lighting, you see that we're missing out on this big red and near infrared spectrum of light, which we'll obviously talk about why that's important now. But the biggest thing I realized is we've basically created indoor lighting for one specific purpose, and that was vision. You know, we don't take into account what kind of physiological effect the indoor lighting is having on us. So while they're becoming extremely energy efficient because they use less electricity, they're cutting out the kinds of spectrum of light that maybe our eyes can't perceive, but I will not directly see, but they can technically perceive, as well as any of our cells, be that skin cells or even, you know, any of your internal organs, if we're talking about some of the more longer frequencies of light. Those things are just completely missing from our spectrum. And that's kind of where we got into red light therapy and we started mitochondria. And I've actually since then stopped working and as a biokineticist and primarily just focusing on mitochondria. And we deal with a whole bunch of people based on, you know, individuals, but also practitioners. So currently we're in a place where we're having, you know, we feel like the best impact we could have on the world. We're reaching people at an education level and teaching people about these things and then supplying people with the tools in order to optimize their health and really create this huge change, because, you know, it's just one of those areas that people don't tend to be paying enough attention to.
Oh, I so relate to that story. And I'm so grateful that you're on this path to help just, you know, no pun intended, shed light on this topic. And really, you know, of course, we're, you know, playful about it, but it really has a huge impact and can make such a difference for so many people on so many levels, even from a mood perspective that, you know, really, really, particularly right now in 2020 and beyond and pandemics, it's so crucial. So I think it could help, because I know when I sometimes will approach this with different clients that are really struggling with their sleep, of all the things, you know, sleep tech is this huge booming industry and so much money is really involved in there, right? And it can occur for some people is like, oh my God, how much money does it cost for me to sleep? What, you know, what do I invest in? What do I not? And so, and when I will recommend often some red light therapy, if people are coming at this green and have no understanding of the connection, why would that help with my sleep? I'm wondering if you can help kind of guide us through the kind of ABCs, and then we can, of course, go more nuanced. But why do we have this connection? How does this work? A little bit more detail on that so the people that are new will really understand this.
Yeah, so there's two kind of mechanisms or two ways that red light therapy can help with your sleep quality. The very first one, I'll quickly just explain the basics of red light therapy. So when we were outside in nature, we would have been exposed to, you know, a wide spectrum of light. And red and near infrared types of light, the longer wavelengths of light, they tended to be the most dominant frequency of light we'd be exposed to. You know, if you were on the equator, you'd probably get exposed to a lot of ultraviolet light, but that might not happen if you were, you know, up in Norway. And it would also vary, you know, depending on the season or whichever. But red and near infrared light at any given stage, whether you're on the equator, whether you're in Norway, whether it's summer, winter, middle of the morning, midday, it is always minimum 42% of all the light coming from the sun is red and near infrared light. So what our cells have basically done is they've decided, okay, well, this is the most dominant frequency of light. So why don't we use this type of light in order to make energy? So I'm sure most people have heard of the mitochondria. That's just a little powerhouse within each and every one of your cells. And these mitochondria use red and near infrared light to make energy. It's very similar to if you could picture a hydro station and you have flowing water and that spins a turbine in order to generate electricity. It's very similar within your cells. They take red and near infrared light and that literally spins a turbine, which helps the cell to make more energy or more ATP. And that mechanism is really important to understand, because when you look in the scientific literature, we're seeing such a wide range of benefits with red light therapy. You know, it almost seems like it's too good to be true. And the reason for that is because, you know, red and near infrared light is affecting you on such a cellular level. You know, whether that is a skin cell, a muscle cell, or even a liver cell, if that cell has more energy, obviously you can expect that it's going to be able to perform its function better. It's like if you had a doctor, an engineer, and an elite athlete, and you gave each of those three people more energy, they'd be able to perform their specific functions better. And that's exactly what we see with red light therapy. As you see, you know, such a wide range of benefits from decreased inflammation, improved sleep quality, improved hair growth. We see all these benefits. And when it comes to sleep, as I said, there's two different mechanisms. The first one is that because each of our cells within our bodies have more energy, systemically, we're going to be able to, let's say, deal with anything. Let's say it's inflammation or some kind of hormonal imbalance. If our bodies systemically are in a better place, it means we're going to be able to function better. And that is often to do with lowering our inflammation levels. And that means lowering our cortisol levels. And as most people are aware, cortisol and your sleep hormone melatonin, they kind of go opposite to each other. So if you can deal with a lot of inflammation and you know, just constant stress that your body's under, your cortisol levels will decrease. That helps your melatonin levels. And there was actually a study, I think it was about 3 years ago, where they took a whole bunch of female basketball players and they did whole body red light therapy every single day for 14 days. And at the end of that time, they noticed, you know, everyone said they had better sleep quality. But when they did some of the actual measurements, they found that when they were tracking all of these athletes' sleep, they were falling asleep 83% quicker. and their levels of melatonin were 75% higher after 2 weeks.
Wow.
Now, that's, you know, they speak about the mechanism in the study, and one of the ways they say is, you know, decreasing that cortisol, and therefore, you know, your the antagonist or the other side, melatonin, is able to lift. That's going to improve your sleep quality and, you know, all the benefits that come with improved sleep. The other mechanism is, as I spoke about earlier, blue light, when we used to make our blue blockers. Blue light is really bad for you at night because it's the type of frequency of light that we would never be exposed to after sunset. During the daytime, you would get blue light from the sun. And our bodies have basically learned that whenever we receive blue light through our eyes or even onto our skin, that's a signal that it's daytime. So what we're doing at night now is we're, you know, being exposed to artificial light. We switch these things on after sunset, and we're constantly giving our brains this daytime signal. And as a result of that, we're increasing our cortisol levels again. That's natural for daytime. And we're suppressing our melatonin levels, which is really important for sleep, also a very powerful antioxidant. So where some people will see, you know, what you will get is benefits from using red light therapy as a session. But even at nighttime now, I mean, you can see my entire environment here is red just after sunset now. So instead of switching on artificial lighting, I've got my screen is already set. I've got an Iris software, IRIS, and that filters out all the blue light from my screen. And then I've got, instead of using, you know, the artificial lighting above my head, I'm using red light here so that it's not giving me that stimulatory effect that you would get from blue light, because red light would actually be, to some degree, a natural, we would be exposed to it a little bit after sunset. We'd be exposed to it in the form of like fires. Those have red and near infrared light. But even in contact with another human body, the way that we receive heat from another human body is near infrared light. So our bodies have, you know, very cleverly learned this type of light is not the kind of light that signals daytime. We'll use blue light for that. But with modern society, we've completely messed that up, and we're exposing ourselves to more blue light. And artificial, you know, the full frequency of light that you would get only during daytime. We're able to do that at night, and that is obviously wreaking problems with our sleep quality. So on one hand, direct red light therapy has that systemic benefit of lowering inflammation and therefore, you know, having as a consequence, increasing your melatonin levels. But on the other side, if you can use it as a lighting source, especially if you have LED lights, they're really durable, you can use those as a light source at night. And then, you know, you don't need to worry that the lighting in your house or anything like that is going to be causing that cortisol spike and melatonin drop and obviously impacting your sleep quality.
Wow. Oh my goodness. I hadn't heard of that basketball study. That's awesome. Lots of great information there. So assuming for many people that are listening, really keen on, of course, improving their sleep, whether it's, you know, just really dismal, total sleep, or they're getting what other people might think of as, you know, pretty decent sleep numbers, but they want to take it to that next level, that we would assume that after hearing all that you've shared about that, there's some interest around red light therapy. So then if there's interest, what I've heard from other clients is like, okay, where do I even begin? Once you start going into, you know, you start Googling red light therapy, there's a lot of numbers of, you know, how do we make sense around the output of this red light therapy? Concerns around flicker rate, time of when we use it. Is it only for the evenings or do we want to bring that in throughout the day? Do we use it to combat our, you know, computer use? Do we not do that? Like kind of just the, you know, with your expertise, the guidance for people of then, okay, so I'm interested, how would this look for me in my life?
Perfect. So I'll start with kind of how to use the device and then I'll discuss maybe what to look out for on the market.
Perfect.
So when it comes to the time of day, you don't have to be too strict with it because as I mentioned, you know, any time of day, whether that's early sunrise or late, you know, in the middle of the day, we've always got at least 43% red and near infrared light from the sun naturally. So red and near infrared light doesn't actually have that much of a stimulatory effect when it comes to your circadian rhythm. That is more dependent on like your blue light because that would change according to the time of day. So it makes sense we would use that type of light. When it comes to like doing a specific session, we often, you know, our clients always recommend like start of the morning is a really good idea. It is when you would get the most red near infrared light from the sun. And it also kind of, you know, helps to offset any artificial blue light that you would be exposed to later in the day if you're working in an office or something like that. But if you can't do it in that time, it's not the end of the world. You know, any time of day does tend to be not going to have any kind of consequence to if you're doing it the wrong time of day. With that said, we do have some customers, and this is from anecdotal experience. We do have some people who find that the light is quite stimulating before bed. And what we've put this down to is it's less to do with the color of the light and more to do with the intensity. You know, red light therapy is using a really bright light in order to deliver you, you know, this therapeutic dose in a relatively short time period. So if you're doing a treatment on your face and you know you've got your eyes closed, you're still going to see a really bright light. Like even though it's red and it has less of a stimulatory effect than if, say, it was blue light, it still can have, you know, that cognitively stimulating effect late at night. Most people don't find it an impact at all. Some people do find a lot of it is just to do with the intensity of light. When it comes to choosing a device, so it's the wild, wild west out there. There are so many different devices on the market, and at such a wide price range, it can be quite hard to decipher, you know, what's really a good red light therapy device and what's just a party light that's going to, you know, light up your room. If you look in the scientific literature, they're not using just a red light bulb. You know, they're using specific LED lights or even lasers in the scientific research. So a couple of things that you can look out for. One of them is the light intensity, which you mentioned, and that is, it's also known as the irradiance. And that is literally just a measurement of the amount of energy that the light is delivering to you. It's measured in milliwatts per centimeter squared. And when it comes to the light intensity, what actually tends to be more important than the actual amount that the company would be telling you is that they tell you how far away from the device they were. Because if you want to start, you know, you can use general guidelines, but if you want to, as a biohacker, you really want to dial in your red light therapy sessions for specific benefits, then you can start looking at the scientific research and, you know, figuring out what dosage or protocol they used. And if you want to do that, you need to make sure that you can get the right specification. So a lot of companies will say, you know, this is our device, it's 100 milliwatts per centimeter squared, and that's all the information they give you. But what they tend to do is they take this measurement right up against the device. So you don't know when you're 6, 12, you know, 18 inches away from the device, you don't know what that light intensity is because it tends to decrease as you get further away. So for full transparency, you know, normally 100 milliwatts per centimeter squared is like a good light intensity or radiance to look at. But more important than that, make sure that you're choosing a device that is, you know, completely transparent with its specifications and tells you how far away they were from the device when they took that specific measurement. The other thing you mentioned was flicker. And for those of you who don't know, our electricity grid is on an alternating current. So that means it switches on and off at a really high rate. So it's either 50 hertz or 60 hertz, depending on where in the world you are. But what this basically means is that especially with LED lights, they flicker on and off at a really high rate, but it's not necessarily perceivable by your eye. If you had to take your phone and record a slow motion video of an LED light in your house, chances are that light will switch on and off in the slow motion video and you'll see it flickering on and off. Now, just because your eyes can't perceive it doesn't mean it doesn't have some kind of effect on your brain. There's a lot of research out there that is now showing that a flickering light can actually have, you know, like this stress response on your brain, and it can lead to things like tension headaches. So if you're using a quality red light therapy device, obviously you want to make sure you're taking, you know, three steps forward and you're not taking one step back because there's kind of an impact from the flickering light. The other one you mentioned was EMFs, electromagnetic fields. For those of you who don't know, those are just, we get natural electromagnetic fields like we would get from the earth. If you were into grounding or something like that, it's magnetism that you would get from the earth and completely natural. Then you get what's called NNEMF, which is non-native electromagnetic fields. And those are, as the word, the name suggests, non-native. They're not what our human, the human body is used to receiving those kind of frequencies of magnetism. Now, any electrical device, because it has a flowing current in it, will emit some kind of electromagnetic field. But what you find is the further away from the, you know, that electromagnetic field may only be a couple of inches away from the device. So if you're using a device that has like a really good light intensity, such as 100 milliwatts per centimeter squared, and they say to you from 6 inches, depending on the device, you know, reputable companies should go and check their devices and see, okay, how far away are we getting electromagnetic fields? And with our mitochondria devices, we go, okay, so we give the first measurement at 6 inches. We don't even say 0 inches. We say 6 inches, you're getting this dosage. And within from 6 inches and beyond, you have zero electromagnetic fields. And again, it's one of those things you don't want to take three steps forward, one step back. You know, we're getting exposed to so many EMFs in the form of, you know, cell phones, Wi-Fi. You know, you don't want to just compound the problem and add those on. And all three of those factors tend to be a problem in some of the cheaper devices. So you might have a low light intensity, so you might not actually get the benefits that you're after. You might have a device that is flickering, you might not see it. But if you film it with a slow motion camera, you might see that the light flickers on and off. And then the third one, obviously, is the electromagnetic fields, which you you need to be a little bit further away from the device in order to make sure that you're not getting any kind of exposure to excessive EMFs.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for walking us through all that. I know that was a mouthful. And I'm curious too, if there are certain myths or things that you think are just particularly noteworthy in the area of red lights. So the thing I mean by that is I know that red light therapy had originally gotten some press for a while when men were talking about using it for testosterone growth kind of increase. Is that something that you think has validity to it? And, or are there any other misnomers or things that just are particularly noteworthy that you wanted to kind of sort through as it relates to things that you hear a lot in this area?
Yeah, so with the testosterone, I'll start with that one. That was made quite famous. There's a biohacker probably most people have heard of called Ben Greenfield, and he did this. There's an article, I think it's in the Men's Health, and it says, red light therapy, shining a red light on my testicles increased my testosterone by 300%. And it makes sense. A lot of guys are, you know, we don't get exposed to any kind of light in that area. And red and near infrared light obviously isn't the type of light that's going to burn you, but it is the type of light that has that stimulatory effect I told you about on your cells. And for a guy, 99% of your testosterone is made there. So we see quite quite high improvements in that, as well as fertility rate. And when I just started out doing red light therapy, I had one of the guys I partnered with, he was actually having some testosterone issues. So he said, okay, well, let's give this a go. So this is just an anecdotal response,
sure.
But it was really great for us to see, you know, to test our products out. And when we started this, I was still working as a biokineticist, and we were in a medical practice that had, you know, a whole bunch of different people. We had physiotherapists, we had massage therapists, and we also had a sports physician. And he actually specialized in testosterone replacement. So we did a baseline testing, and we got, this is my friend's baseline testing of his testosterone, and he was definitely on the low side. I forget the metrics, it was about 10 something, I think milligrams per liter units. I think that was the unit. It was 10. And what he did then is once a day for 10 minutes, he would use the red light, shine them at his testes. And then after 2 weeks, we did a retest. And what we saw is that his values went up, it was up to 17 point something. So he'd seen a 70% increase in testosterone. And the physician that we were, who did all our testing for us, he didn't play too much of a part. We just said, do a test for us. That's all we wanted you to do.
Right.
He said he wouldn't have been able to get that drastic of an improvement, even if he'd been injecting testosterone. His body wouldn't have taken it up that quickly if it was an exogenous form of testosterone. So that was really great. We saw, you know, that was just kind of putting faith in the product and what we're doing. And there's been a lot of guys, there isn't a lot of research directly to do with testosterone. There's a lot of research to do with fertility. I think there's a lot of ethics issues around trying to get people to shine a light in that area. But if you go into like the biohacking kind of groups and that and communities, there's a lot of guys who are saying, you know, they see improvements when they do their blood work. We've actually got a customer who's just done some blood work and is promising me some values in the next few weeks. And anecdotally, also what a lot of people say is they notice, especially as a man, they kind of feel the effects of what it would be like to have more testosterone. So they say all of a sudden they have a little bit more muscle definition, or their mood is better, their libido is better. So even if someone doesn't go and get the lab work done, a lot of people say, you know, anecdotally, again, I'm saying here, but they say, you know, this feels like what you would expect if you were getting an increase in testosterone.
Wow. How are there not more studies on this? This seems like this would be a very exciting area for a big half of our population.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then you asked, I remember I had something, you said something that is a bit of a nuance or something that's, you know, maybe a myth or something about red light therapy.
Sure.
What's very interesting is one of the most common questions we get is, will red light therapy help to increase my vitamin D levels? And the direct answer is no. Red light therapy, or red and near infrared light, is not responsible for making vitamin D. You actually require ultraviolet light, and that needs to come into contact with your skin. And in your skin, your body then converts cholesterol into vitamin D. Indirectly, however, where there's a lot of research that shows that red and near infrared light is able to improve your ability to actually absorb ultraviolet light. And this actually makes sense even if you look at nature. If we had a sunrise in the early morning, we would, because the sun is in the horizon, it has further to travel before it gets to us. And as a consequence, we don't see the shorter wavelengths of light, such as ultraviolet light, and we get a really high concentration of red and near infrared light. So in the early morning, if you're outside and getting exposed to that type of light, it basically warns your skin cells. It's like, okay, today, you know, the sun's coming just now, start preparing for that. So your body starts upregulating or activating melanin in your skin, which is one of the pigments that helps to prevent sunburn. And as a consequence, you start seeing when you do go out later in the day, then exposure to ultraviolet light has less of a negative side effect. Obviously, overdoing it with ultraviolet light can have its negative side effects, but you do need to have a healthy dose of it. So a lot of people ask this question, and it's, yes, it maybe it helps facilitate it, because there's research where, I mean, they literally take, there's one study where they, one person, two legs, as most humans are, and they apply red light therapy to one leg, one of their legs, and then 10 minutes later, they expose both of the legs to ultraviolet light. And what you find is that the leg that was exposed to red and near-infrared light has significantly less sunburn or red-like damage, even like 24, 48 hours after the incident of ultraviolet light. So if you are someone who finds that you're burning every time you go outside in the sun, red light therapy can be a really great tool in order to help prepare your skin and build up your solar callus, so that when you do go outside in, you know, let's say later in the day, then, you know, you can be a little bit more safe. And obviously then you might not have to use as much sunscreen, which we don't need to talk about too much, but obviously there's, you know, risks you're taking if you're using a lot of chemicals on your skin, and you're then also blocking out some of the healthier wavelengths of light that you should be getting in.
Oh, I'm so glad you touched on the vitamin D topic, and also helped to educate, because there's so many people that I'll speak with when making the argument that so much of getting great sleep involves our connection to nature and to being outside more regularly than certainly the average person might be nowadays. So the fact that you illustrated that, it can also create a new relationship for many people with the sun. There's many kind of a past-based way of looking at how we interact with that many people, you know, I might be working with people 65 and older, and they've spent so much of their life layering up in sunscreen. And so what you're speaking to is really revolutionary for a lot of people around prioritizing that time in that infrared exposure, getting that infrared exposure so that it can actually help make a difference and prime you to handle the sun and get all the benefits of the sun in such a powerful and very important way as it relates to sleep. So thank you for illustrating that. I'll also make the argument at different points too of skin health. And I was wondering if you could share more about red light's effects on things like that, the autoimmune issues, skin issues, and things that, you know, because of course we're talking about this area of sleep, but it is certainly a total health package. And so if we're looking to invest to know some of these things that can really be problematic for people and how that can make a difference, I think is really important.
Yeah, so we can talk about the connection between sleep and any of those issues.
Yeah.
But even a more fundamental level, red light therapy is able to help with inflammation. And just to give someone a brief idea of what inflammation is actually just when your cell is not functioning properly, and it gets, basically your cell gets tagged as this cell needs to die. Your immune system starts attacking that cell because it's been tagged with inflammatory markers, they're called cytokines. And red light therapy, because if it is aimed at a specific cell that is, you know, not functioning properly, if it is able to produce more energy in that cell, there's a much lower chance of that cell being tagged as a non-useful cell. And therefore, we see a decrease in inflammation. It means your immune system is not going to be overly active. So with something like psoriasis is heavily involved. It's inflammation in your skin. So if you can get red light therapy on that area, it's going to help to deal with that inflammation. And your skin cells, your immune system is going to stop attacking your skin cells. And that's when you see, you know, this great improvements in with psoriasis. Autoimmune conditions, again, autoimmunity is your own immune system attacking yourself. That is, again, inflammation. So it is, you know, another mechanism where, you know, red light therapy is not going to cure Lyme disease or, you know, any kind of, you know, autoimmune condition, but it can definitely, you know, decrease the symptoms and help people. I mean, whichever kind of autoimmune disease, I always invite people, because it always seems too good to be true, go into a scientific database, something like PubMed, and type in red light therapy and whatever you want to put in. And chances are 99% of the time, you're probably going to see some kind of correlation between red light therapy and some disease. Because there's always, because of how it works on such a fundamental level, we see, you know, such a wide range of benefits, as I mentioned earlier. One thing, if you don't mind, I just wanted to add, and you were talking about getting natural light exposure and sleep. Again, I just wanted to add that, you know, sunscreen, that's one thing. Another thing is sunglasses. A lot of people are wearing sunglasses every time they go outside. And what most people don't realize is that, you know, yes, at night, it's really important to block blue light so that you can increase your melatonin. But when we look at where melatonin comes from, what actually happens is ultraviolet A, it's a type of ultraviolet light. It's not as harsh as your UVB light. But ultraviolet A light, when that goes through your eye, that converts tryptophan into serotonin, which is one of your, you know, feel-good kind of neurotransmitters. And at nighttime, in the presence of darkness, which is when you should be blocking your blue light, your body then converts serotonin into melatonin. So if you're just blocking artificial light at night, but you're not actually getting outside during the daytime, you're not going to see as great an impact as if you were getting outside during the day, build up those serotonin levels, and then at nighttime in the presence of darkness, that'll get converted into melatonin. So just my extra piece on there is, you know, don't always wear your sunglasses outside. You know, it is completely natural for the human eye to be exposed to a certain amount of light. Obviously, when you first go outside, you know, use common sense and don't stare directly at the sun. Most of us are so conditioned to being inside that going outside is, you know, often too bright. But it's definitely one of those things I've noticed with myself, my family, and all of our customers basically have always said, either through red light therapy or just getting outside more, they quickly notice that that kind of glare effect that happens when they're outside tends to disappear after a while as you kind of get more used to natural light that you would be exposed to instead of just indoor lighting.
Oh, yeah. Such a good call out. That was one of the biggest behavioral change elements for myself. I wouldn't go anywhere without sunglasses for so much of my life. And to finally put them aside was like a big deal. And I'm so glad you called that out because it's so impactful. And you know, some of these things, it can occur as a lot for people in the beginning. But once we start making some of these basic shifts, it really becomes a set it and forget it. And it can be so, so beneficial. And I love that you also, you took us through the element of serotonin. And I was speaking with another red light company and they were making the push for exposing red light to the gut for gut health and that production of serotonin. Is that something that you also advocate for as it relates to sleep?
Absolutely. I mean, so most people aren't aware that most serotonin is made in your gut. And then that, you know, is connected by the brain-gut axis. And red and near infrared light is able to penetrate 15, 20 centimeters into our tissue, so it can actually get to your gut. And when you start looking at light on a fundamental level and you start looking at how, you know, how it's interconnected with everything in our lives, essentially, if you look at food, food is just stored light. You know, we are getting energy from the sun that is being absorbed by plants. They're turning, you know, plants are growing. And whether you're eating a plant or whether an animal eats that plant, indirectly, you're getting some form of light. Light is a fundamental mechanism of energy transfer within humans. Now, well, this is very interesting. There's a guy called Dr. Jack Kruse, who's he's an extreme guru in the whole light and circadian rhythm industry. And he was talking about, you know, we have receptors for light. We have them on our eye. We have them in our skin. And the other place that we have it is on the endothelial lining within our stomachs. And what actually happens is you eat food, and that goes down into your stomach, and your microbiome actually breaks down this light and releases it as light. So your gut lining is receiving photons of light. It's almost like the way that Jack explains it is if you had a projector, then it's almost like your stomach is that lining, and the gut biome within there are they're releasing this light so that your stomach lining or the projector is able to absorb it. So your gut pays a very strong attention to the type of light that you're being exposed to. And it does that for a very specific reason, and that is that the type of light you're being exposed to will tell your body what kind of food will be available in your environment. You know, our gut microbiome is meant to change with the season. In winter months, we wouldn't necessarily get as many carbohydrates. It wouldn't be, you know, freely available because fruit tends to grow more in the summer. Whereas in summer, obviously, then we get more ultraviolet light, more stronger light cycles. The environment produces more ultraviolet light produces more carbohydrates. Therefore, our gut biome actually changes its, call it composition, in order to prepare for the type of food that we'd be exposed to. And there's a very interesting study that Jack also actually referenced was they studied, it was with, I think it was the Hazda tribe in, I think it's Tanzania. And what they noticed is that their microbiome was changing so much across the different seasons. And what they basically were figuring out is it's not necessarily the type of food that you eat does have some kind of impact on your microbiome. But even more importantly than that, your light environment tends to almost be a stronger changer of your gut biome. And, you know, at first this doesn't seem to make sense, but if you think about what would happen in nature, in summer months, we would have lots, you know, really strong light cycles and ultraviolet light. But then in, you know, as the fall starts happening and we start getting shorter light cycles, the best thing that we can do for winter is to start storing a little bit of fat. So what happens is you start getting exposed to less ultraviolet light. As a consequence, your vitamin D levels will go down a bit. And that also means that you're not going to be that good at metabolizing carbohydrates. So come the autumn, we're getting lower levels of vitamin D, and we've still got a little bit of carbohydrates that are available in the environment. So as a consequence, your body goes, okay, low vitamin D levels plus carbohydrates equals a signal, winter's coming, let's start storing fat. And this becomes a huge issue when you look at how most people are living our lives these days. No matter where in the world you are, you can get a banana, you know, 365 days of the year. So this not eating according to what's in your environment creates a whole bunch of mismatches between, you know, your life environment, your gut, and the type of food you're eating. You know, this is definitely a key component of, you know, all these metabolic syndromes issues that we have is, you know, out of season eating. If you're eating carbohydrates and your vitamin D levels are really high, you find that people don't tend to put on as much weight. I mean, there's a lot of, if you look at, you know, the areas in the world where we have the worst diabetic or the highest diabetic prevalence amongst the population, it tends to be the furthest away from the equator, which is where we get the least amount of ultraviolet light, which is where it should be naturally the least likely that you would get carbohydrates freely in the environment. So in a roundabout way, what I'm saying is your life environment has a very big impact on your gut microbiome. And you should be eating the food that is locally within your region and making sure that you're getting outside into natural light in order to create a harmony between your life environment and the food that you're eating.
Oh, I love that. And yeah, I'm so glad you acknowledged Jack Cruz, really just paramount in what he's teaching for so many people and spreading also this passion around this area. And certainly even in your speaking, the passion is evident. And in that vein, what would you just say is some of the ways that your life itself looks different now that you've, you know, really indoctrinated this way of looking at the world, at your environment, its impact on your health? You know, I know that's a big question, but are there some kind of key takeaways, you know, things like, you know, not wearing sunglasses, getting outside at certain times, all of these things can be a big, big shift for people. Are there other things that you're doing as it relates to where you choose to live or how you choose to live your life that have really made a big impact on you?
The biggest thing that I've taken away from everything that I've learned so far is that you shouldn't get too caught up in what most people are doing or in what, you know, current research is saying. Well, I say current research. There's always some research out there that is funded by something, and you should always, basically, I'm just saying, question everything that you have. But your number, your compass when it comes to health is nature. What would we have been exposed to in nature? And I would, you know, I always look back and I kick myself and I'm like, how did I believe that the sunlight was bad for me, but I didn't have to do anything about indoor lighting? You know, if you start wearing blue blockers inside, people think you're crazy. But then at the end of the day, you're like, hold on a second. We evolved under the sun, yet now we're getting exposed to unnatural artificial light. I'm protecting myself from that, but you think I'm crazy because I'm going out in natural light. Your compass when it comes to health, I've realized, is if something isn't in line with what you would have seen in nature, I would always be skeptical of it and question it.
I love that. Ah, and it's so refreshing during a time of, you know, 2020 pandemics, staying inside, pushing us all, you know, to be even more disconnected from nature as kind of a social narrative. So I appreciate more and more people that are standing up and really helping to share what's possible as far as our health and, you know, the transformations that you've seen for yourself and for the people that you work with. It's so, so important. So how can people learn more about you? And of course, you know, you've dedicated your life to creating these products around helping people in this area. How can they learn more, follow you, all the things?
So on social media, I mean, on Instagram is probably the best place to follow our company. So it's at Mychondria, that's Mychondria. But then on Facebook, we've got a really awesome group. It's called Circadian Warriors. And it's not just about light, it's anything to do with circadian rhythms. Obviously, the most important aspect when it comes to having a healthy circadian rhythm and optimizing your sleep is light. So predominantly, we talk about light, but there's a lot of other factors that are talking about that are spoken about there. On Instagram, I'm actually circadian_warrior. I mean, I obviously put out a lot of content all around circadian rhythms, light, and other kind of fields of, you know, light circadian rhythm kind of context. But I would say number one, Instagram, Mychondria, at Mychondria, Mychondria. Otherwise, our website is Mychondria. If anyone wants to get like a free red light therapy guide, we do have, if you go to www.mychondria.com/2020, there's a link there where you can basically get a free PDF that just gives you an overarching view on red light therapy, including how to use it, the benefits, and, you know, what to look out for when choosing a device.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, we'll make sure to get all of that in the show notes too, so that you can just make sure you click through, get that information, you know, so I know, because you gave so much value on this conversation, and then to be able to underscore it for people and see it in black and white will be helpful as well, because I know it's a lot to take in for a lot of people. So I just want to really thank you for the work that you're doing, for you're clearly living this, and just it stands for people as an example of what's possible. So I really appreciate what you're up to, and I can't wait to follow more between your company and the work you're putting out. It's very exciting.
Thank you. And I really appreciate, the opportunity to speak to your audience. You know, whenever it's something to do with sleep, it's a complete passion of mine. This doesn't feel like work. When it's talking to people about sleep, I feel like, you know, when I'm walking down the street and I'm trying to talk to the general person, I can't be like, you need to fix your sleep.
But, yes.
You know, now I'm not crazy. Like, I walk out of here, I'm a crazy person. But when I'm talking to you guys, I know that I'm not insane.
Oh, I love it. Yes. You found your people for sure. Well, I really appreciate it. And looking forward to staying connected and following all the work you're doing. So thank you.
You've been listening to the Sleep is a Skill podcast, the number one podcast for people who want to take their sleep skills to the next level. Every Monday, I send out something that I call Molly's Monday Obsessions, containing everything that I'm obsessing over in the world of sleep. Head on over to sleepisaskill.com to sign up.